The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jack Wilson. There's no theme song this time, and there won't be much literature. This one is all about context. It's the context of America, the context of Washington, D.C., where I live and work, the context of the nation I call home, and the people I call fellow Americans. Why this? Why now? I'm still of the opinion that the podcast should be an escape. Others can talk politics, they do it better, they're more focused on it. You seek them out when that is what you need. I'd like literature to be a refuge for you, a place to spend an hour where you don't hear the news of the day, whatever that is. I'm aware that it creeps in. I'm human. I talk about things. I talk about life. I talk about issues. Sometimes that's unavoidable. Sometimes the news of the day is what creeps in, but I try to keep it out most of the time. Another reason is simpler. There's the element of time. I record the shows in advance, sometimes a week or two in advance, and by the time an episode is released, the headlines are over. They're stale. Nobody cares. And there's the issue of the archive. I love it when someone tells me they've been back in the archive listening to the Thomas Hardy episode or the Shirley Jackson episode or the Madame Bovary episode. I'm sure they wouldn't want to hear my views from years ago of the forthcoming such-and-such bill and whether it has a chance of passage in the Senate. The less I talk about politics, the more evergreen those archives will be. I get it. Today is different. Today is different. Today I'm feeling like the events are moving so fast, I don't really trust the episodes that are coming out. We're in the middle of Alice Munro week, and it feels strange to me that those episodes are posting, and I don't have anything in them about the events that we are currently experiencing in America. Yesterday, last night, it was a bizarre day in America. Bizarre doesn't really do it justice. Last night, I happened to turn on the television to watch a report of a peaceful protest by Lafayette Park, which is near the White House here in D.C. I've been there many times. I used to work a few blocks away for years. In any case, the protest was peaceful. The camera operator and reporter were there filming everything when suddenly mounted police arrived, marching down the middle of the street. Tear gas and rubber bullets followed. The street was cleared of protesters. The only reason I'm using the passive voice here is because I'm not sure who the authorities were. The reporter wasn't either. He thought it was federal. It might have been Secret Service, might have been National Guard, might have been DC police, although, as I say, he said they were federal. It's not clear to me. There were military helicopters hovering overhead. Was a show of force. That's the important thing. And the march to clear the protesters was to get them to another part of town. And then, this is all in the span of about 15 to 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes of watching the news. The president gave a speech and walked across the street to a church where he held up a Bible in an awkward way, posed for some pictures, and left. Now, this comes at the end of a week of protests all over the country. It started because of a video that emerged of a man named George Floyd, who was held down by police officers in Minneapolis. The officers kneeled on his body and his neck for several minutes in spite of his protests, his plaintive cries, and they killed him. They killed him in the street. He was black. And black Americans everywhere, and white Americans too, were horrified by the video, which itself comes in the context of years, decades of police mistreatment of citizens, especially black people. We can caveat this and say that many, many police officers are decent and hardworking and are as horrified as anyone else when by the video. Just as when we caveat the protests and the riots, we say that many, many of the protesters are peaceful. There are reports of infiltration of white supremacist groups arriving in the middle of the protests, turning them into riots, handing out bricks, starting trouble. Their goal to incite a race war, which they will use for their benefit, will justify crackdowns. I'm sure that is happening too. I'm not going to issue a caveat for those monsters. They're not fine people. They're not good Americans. They're not expressing an opinion. They're murderous people, poisoned souls, and they can burn in hell for all I care. But I wouldn't kneel on their neck. See, that's the thing. They're enemies. I hate them. I absolutely despise them. And I would want to see them arrested, prosecuted, sit in jail for life, not murdered by police in the streets. And that's what black people are saying. They're saying, why is it okay for a police officer? And look, these particular police officers caught on video are going to be dealt with. They'll face trial, and it's hard to imagine that they won't spend time in jail. I can't promise that will occur. I can't promise justice will be served, because we've all seen what happens in cases like this. We've seen when officers go free, but it doesn't matter to the point I'm making. The point I'm making is that police brutality occurs. Racial profiling happens. Black people live in fear of the police. The men and women who are authorized to walk around with instruments of force attached to their belt or in their hand, guns, clubs, tasers, they're authorized by the government, by the taxes we all pay, to have those weapons and to use them against the citizens. And black people are saying they are using them against innocent people. They are using them in disproportionate fashion. They are targeting us. They abuse the power that they are given. And our people are hurt. Our people are damaged. Our people are getting killed. Pay attention to this. Admit this. Acknowledge it. Change it. That's the message. 89% of the country, I saw in one poll, agreed that the force used on George Floyd should not have been used, that it was too much, went too far. 89%, that's a high number for America, who rarely agrees on anything more than 60-40 or 55-45. This is something we agree on. Americans do not want police powers to be abused. And this, as seen in the video, went too far. But why did it happen? Why did we let it get to the point where it could happen? Four officers were there. Let me tell you, if one of my colleagues put his knee on someone's neck, I'd be knocking them off that person. Officers should be trained to do the same. Officers should be told that this is not okay. They should be trained to exercise restraint, to not go too far, to stop their colleagues from going too far, to stop them from murder. Apparently, they are not trained in this, or not trained in a way that works. When the chips are down, it's not stopped. We've seen it now in the video. I saw a clip from a speech by the head of the Minneapolis Police Union, who's speaking at a rally for Trump. And he says something like, Trump has taken off the handcuffs of the police, so we can use those handcuffs instead of wearing them. Something like that. Apparently, Minneapolis has had a whole string of incidents, had problems dating back years. Their police chief invited the Obama Department of Justice to come in and do a review. And they made a bunch of recommendations for how to reduce police brutality. And that led to police feeling like they couldn't do their job. And I get it. They have a tough job. They're in danger a lot of the time. They're asked to endure a lot of verbal abuse and attitudes, and they deal with people who are at their worst. Sometimes they're angriest, or they're most unstable, or they're most dangerous. Nobody wants police, just like firefighters and nurses and emergency room technicians. Nobody wants them to have to do their job in a way that makes them feel unsafe or actually be unsafe when they're out there responding to emergencies, helping people, doing what we ask them to do. But here's the difference. Is their job, as they see it, limited to the task at hand? Is it to arrest a suspect, to break up a fight, respond to an emergency? Or do they view their purpose as something broader? Do they think what they need to do is send a message? Is it cracking down to frighten people into submission? Is it about revenge? Is it about exerting power to make people afraid of power? To make people stay home? Those are tougher questions. We'll have a few answers. We'll address this more in a few minutes. But first, I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about pressure and pressure valves. One of the most striking things I've ever read is Plato's Crito, the dialogue. Socrates, in this dialogue, has been sentenced to death unfairly, and he's given the chance to escape. He doesn't take it. He says, "What right do I have to take the chance? Haven't I lived under these laws, under this system of justice here in Athens? I didn't change those laws. I accepted them. Now, don't I have to accept the consequences?" Those words of Socrates, that whole dialogue, was deeply affecting to me, deeply moving. It made me think about our relationship to our government. Where does power come from? I believe in democracy. I believe in the Constitution. I believe in that America, which I've lived in all my life. I believe it has to be that power comes from elections, not wealth or privilege or might. Power comes from elections. Elections at all levels, state, local, federal. I believe that power and authority derive from the consent of the governed. Your preferred candidate might lose an election, but if you think the elections are fair, you have consented to live by that choice. Your obligation is to change the outcome of the next election or to change the minds of those currently holding power through reason, through exercise of your free speech, or by peaceful assembly, by nonviolent protest. That's the system. That's the deal. I said I would talk about pressure and pressure valves. A lot of people have Instant Pots now. They've become a sort of Christmas Day staple, Instant Pot under the tree. You can make great soups in them. You can make gorgeous lentils. You can cook a whole chicken in a matter of minutes, whatever you want. They cook with heat and pressure, and you can get great results. I like the slow cooker myself, but the pressure cooker is good too. I waited too long to get mine. And why did I wait? Because when I was a kid, people had pressure cookers. They had pressure cookers and deep fryers. Kitchens in the 70s had deep fryers, hot oil being made in a device just balancing on a countertop with a dangling cord. Well, they still exist. People, I think, are a little more careful now. Back then, you'd have pets running around, babies, and a dangling cord that someone could accidentally trip over, yanking the thing to the side, toppling it. Can you imagine how many burns that were caused by that hot oil in those fry babies? There were other dangers too. My grandparents had a fry baby, and they were so excited by getting it that they had their friends Tony and Leona over for dinner to eat fish. Fish that my grandfather had caught himself. And they served up the fried fish, and Tony and Leona started picking at it a little bit. They said, "Are you sure this is okay?" My grandfather was kind of proud and kind of fiery. He could be a little feisty. "Ah, yes, of course it's okay. That's fresh fish." And they picked at it a little more and said, "Well, it tastes a little odd, you know?" And he responded with his typical outrage. "Well, you're not used to fresh fish." "But doesn't it look a little blue?" "Well," he said, "they're bluegill." So they ate all the fish, and Tony and Leona went home, and my grandparents were cleaning up the kitchen, doing the dishes, and my grandmother said, "Hey, by the way, what happened to our blue spatula?" They had a plastic spatula that they were using to lift the fish in and out of the fry baby, and my grandfather had left it in the oil, and it just melted into the oil, just oozed down. A whole plastic spatula became part of the dinner that they served. That was the fry baby. That's the 70s. That's the kitchen in the 70s. And the pressure cookers back then were just as dangerous. They blew up. They blew up, sending the whole dinner, the soup, the lentils, the poor chicken, the spaghetti sauce, smashing up against the ceiling. Story after story of explosions, burns, trips to the ER, meals ruined, ceilings that needed to be repaired and repainted. So, for decades, no pressure cookers in the kitchens until the Instant Pot came along. Now they're back, and the big reason why is that they are much safer. Why are they safe? Well, there's a whole bunch of reasons. One of them is they improved the pressure valve. It's also called a release valve, a safety valve. Pressure valves were invented by a Frenchman a few hundred years ago who was trying to get jelly out of bones because the king found that very tasty, liked to eat it. So this Frenchman had a device to exert pressure on the bones, looking to extract that tasty jelly. But the device kept blowing up. So he invented the pressure valve to divert the pressure, release enough steam so that the pressure didn't build to the point of explosion. Steam is powerful. It can drive a locomotive. Locomotives, when they were invented, used the pressure valves too. When you have a lot of pressure building in a chamber and you're trying to harness that power, whether it's for cooking or anything else, you want to make sure you can safely release some of it before it blows up the whole device. The old pressure cookers, the kind your grandmother had, were relying on a tight lid. Heat the thing up, tighten the lid, keep it tight, keep it clamped down, keep the pressure inside. Take the thing off the stove, let the pressure slowly reduce. That's pretty dangerous. You open it up too soon, blam. Heat it too high, blam. The lid can only be so tight. The pressure has nowhere to go. The whole thing can explode. Now, society, American society, has pressure valves built into it. The system of checks and balances is designed as a set of pressure valves. Democracy itself is a pressure valve. What's the problem with living under an authoritarian? Let me give you another example first. We'll come back to that question. Consider the jury system. Why do we have it? Everyone grumbles about going to serve on a jury, taking time out of your schedule to do it. It's not universal. Other countries just have judges play that role. You could still have lawyers on both sides, still have a fair trial, everyone gets a fair hearing, and you just have an impartial judge determining guilt or innocence and deciding the sentence. There are some advantages to that. Judges can be trained. They can be professional. They become familiar with the law. They might be better at weighing evidence than 12 novices. We could expect that, right? And we wouldn't have the burden of selecting a jury, of having people show up, of paying them for their time. Do away with all that rigmarole, all that expense. So why don't we? Why don't we do that? Because the jury is a pressure valve. Here's what we think here in America. We think that if judges are in charge of all that, we'll have a whole class of people, people in power, authority figures, who will be hated by their fellow citizens. Everyone will have a story of a judge who found their friend or neighbor or family member guilty. Over time, a judge in a community might become very powerful, handing out sentences, handing out mercy, even more so than now. Prosecutors will lose one of their outs too. Right now, they can say, look, all I did was present the case to 12 members of the community. They're the ones who found the guy guilty. And the judges could become corrupt. We take all that away with the 12-member jury. That's how the jury system works. Not because people think it's better, although maybe that's partially true. Maybe the 12 people in the jury do get things right more often because there are no shortcuts. They're not corruptible in the same way. they're coming to a case fresh. You have to persuade them. They have real life experience that lawyers and judges might not have. And the jury holds prosecutors and judges and defense counsel and police witnesses accountable to some degree. But even if they're not better than a judge would be, overall, the effect is to release pressure. It's a damn hard thing for a society to have to lock people up. It can rip families apart and cause hatred and animosity for decades. Serving justice is not easy. Having all of that happen because of what a jury decides, assuming everything is done fairly, is a way of hoping that people will recognize that the wheels of justice are turning with some fairness. As a citizen, I might think, okay, fine, I agree that we need some laws. I agree that we need to deal with lawbreakers. Prisons are necessary. So is some form of trial. And okay, fine, 12 of my peers can make that decision if it's ever me who's sitting there accused. I don't want corrupt judges deciding. I don't want authority figures making that decision without a fair trial. If you're designing a government, you hope that the public accepts the state's right to preserve order. You want the governed to consent to the mechanisms of that process. That's the goal. That's what the founding fathers were trying to achieve. The alternative is to seize power and rule through strength and fear. That's the alternative to the consent of the governed model. Hold that thought for a moment, too. We'll return to that. Now, what happens when the jury model is broken? What if you're in the South and the prosecutor can eliminate any juror he wants and he keeps crossing off black jurors? Over and over and over, you get all white juries and they start convicting black people without really weighing the evidence in the same way. If the white prosecutor thinks that this black guy committed a crime, he must have done it, right? Guilty, guilty, guilty. What happens then? A lot of black people go to jail. Maybe some were guilty. Maybe most. Let's even say they all were. There's no way it was all, but let's pretend that prosecutors are infallible and everyone who goes to jail under that system was actually guilty. What do we say about it? That it's efficient? That it's foolproof? That it's all pros and no cons? Well, no. Think of it as the pressure cooker. Think of our model as the pressure cooker, that society has pressures that it's under. Maybe in this case, we're sending the right people to jail with our all-white juries, but what does that do to the black community? The black community says, I see these guys on the jury. They don't look like me. They don't go to my church. They have their own. I'm not allowed in their schools or swimming pools, their neighborhoods. They demonstrate hatred toward me all the time. And now they're putting my brother or my father or my mother or my baby boy in jail. They're deciding on the guilt of my loved one. Now, I'm sorry I even raised the possibility of an infallible prosecutor because we know they're not infallible. They're working under conditions where 100% certainty is rare and it's not even expected. We know that. The evidence standard is beyond a reasonable doubt. So who's making that judgment call? Whose doubt is being supplied? Whose certainty is being applied? Who's being reasonable? Who's being asked to weigh the evidence and apply their background, their experience, their wisdom, their knowledge of the world, their reason, their ability to weigh evidence? If it's 12 white people who live in a different place and live according to different rules, is that going to be the same? Or do you want a fair mix, a better chance and being impartial? You're more likely to get better results if you have a representative society. I believe that's true. But here's what I know is true. If you don't have representation from all walks of life, if you put your thumb on the scale of who sits on the jury, whether it's whites only or old people only or rich people only or Catholics only or whatever you choose, whatever criteria you use, you will have black people or young people or poor people or Protestants. You will have the excluded group say, hang on a second, is this fair? They're locking people up people like me, and that's according to their judgment, their definition of reasonable, their doubts or level of certainty. They're locking us up. It's not we who are locking some of our fellow citizens up. It's they who are doing it to us. That's pressure without a valve. Pressure that's building, pressure that's waiting to boil over. The valve is there, the jury system, but it's not working correctly. It needs to be refined. Okay. When you start seeing pressure valves, you see them all over society. Why don't we have a king? Why not a dictator? Why not a president for life? What's the problem with those things? Don't we like the idea of powerful people telling us what to do? Ask yourself, do you want to pay taxes? Set aside cults of personality. I don't think anyone wants that, where you pay your taxes with joy as if you're giving the king a nice birthday present or something. No, kings are going to do things we like and things we don't like. But we'll remember the things we don't like at tax time, and we'll wonder, why the hell do we have to pay for those? Pressure builds. Why have I been paying for this president for life all these years, this king? Why am I fighting in his army? Why am I sending my sons and daughters off to war? Why? I don't like it. Who said this has to be the case? Why am I sacrificing my life for this king? Pressure builds. Democracy says, hang on. You voted for this, or you didn't vote at all. You had a chance to make a difference. You've chosen to be governed in this way. That's a pressure valve. Pressure is released through those elections. And there's a Congress and a judiciary that's supposed to be independent. Those are supposed to be pressure valves too. Not every anger, every resentment, every frustration is supposed to be directed at the president. That would build too much pressure. It's supposed to be dispersed. Power is supposed to be dispersed. We're supposed to feel we governed, are supposed to feel as if the system might not deliver every outcome we want, but the setup at least is fair. Elections are our pressure valve. Next problem, majority rule. Elections might not release pressure if the majority constantly votes to oppress the minority, right? You might live your whole life and think, I'm part of a group that's only 20% of the population. We never win anything. Our voice doesn't matter. Consent of the governed? What are you talking about? I'm governed. And I didn't consent to any of this, and neither did my grandparents, and neither will my grandkids. And here's where we have another form of pressure valve. The Bill of Rights. The right to free speech, the right to assemble, freedom of religion. You might not get anything you want through elections. Elections might only put in place people who want to oppress you. But the Bill of Rights says, okay, fine. The government isn't always going to work for all people. But it can only go so far. It can't stop you from expressing your ideas and talking about your problems, talking about your vision for a better society. It can't tell you that you can't say those things. It can't tell you that you have to stay home and be quiet and disappear. You can't be singled out for race or religion and persecuted just because you have those attributes. You'll get to live with some dignity. Worship your own God, speak your mind, go where you want to go. It's not perfect, but it releases some pressure. What happens when this pressure is not released? The governed do not consent to power. That leads to protests. It leads to unrest. It leads potentially to disobedience or riots or rebellion, revolution. Now, let's talk about the police. Nobody has consented to a knee on the neck. Nobody voted for that to be the policy. Nobody has said, let's throw out our courts, our fair trials, the rights of the accused. Let's just throw people in jail without trial. Let's go further. Let's just let the police make the call right there in the street. They can kill who they want. Nobody has put that system in place. That's not the system we have, clearly. We see that with the outrage. That's the 89% who say, whoa, 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 hang on. That's not what we want from our police. And yet, it's happening. And the leaders in Minnesota kind of bungled the response, and not just because they happened to have a bad day, but because the system is built to bungle the response. It reflexively sides with the cops. We all know that to be true. Here we have a video of a murder, a horrifying murder, and the prosecutor in the case is talking vaguely about needing to weigh all the evidence and that there's evidence that suggests the force was justified and all of that. And the police know that this happens. There have been hundreds of complaints in Minneapolis. There are thousands of instances all over the country. And the head of Minneapolis's police union is at a Trump rally thanking the president for taking the cuffs off of the officers. Unleash us, he's saying. The people in the black community say, what is this? Why do we have to live like this? Why do we get singled out, thrown to the ground? Arrest us, fine. Take us to jail, fine. We'll face trial, okay. If all that is fair, if it's done fairly, okay. That's the system. But if you're doing any of that unfairly, if there's an unfair piece in that, we aren't going to stand for it. You want us to consent to that? No. The pressure will build. And if you're not even bothering to put us into that system, if you're letting murderers wear the uniform and hold the tasers and the guns and tell them it's okay to kneel on the neck of the accused, if that's your process, if that's what you're doing, recruiting people who will do that, or not rooting them out when you find them, or encouraging them, or tolerating it, or whatever is happening, however it is we get to that point, if you think, well, a little violence is good for those folks, a little violence keeps people in line, a few knees to the neck will show black people that white people are still in charge, and they need to remember it. If that's the plan, white people, then don't expect us to consent. And a lot of white people watched that video and were sick to their stomach, and they don't want this happening either. Suddenly you have a whole lot of people who are saying, okay, here's the pressure. This video has turned up the heat. It's created the pressure. Where is the valve? Where is the pressure valve? I don't see it in this officer who isn't acting with an appropriate level of force. I don't see it in his colleagues who are witnessing a murder and doing nothing to stop it. If anything, they are participating in it. Pressure, valve, one. Police who don't abuse their power. That one has failed us here. The pressure is building. Where's the next valve? Are we headed for an explosion? Or will there be a release? Which brings me to our president. Presidents are not all powerful in our system. Power is distributed. There are governors, there are mayors, there are city councils and state legislatures and Congress. We do not have a supreme leader. The Constitution is quite clear about that. If you think we have a supreme leader, if you think that's the system we should have, you don't want our Constitution, you want something else. It'd be like saying, I believe in Satan and the Bible is my book. No, it's not. You need a different book. You're reading this one all wrong. So, we don't have a supreme leader, but we do have a single authority with a lot of power. The most power that any single individual has in our system. And the person is not just the head of a political party or a faction or a tribe of people. That's not what he wins when he wins an election. He sits at the top of the pyramid, and the pyramid is full of all of the people, all Americans. We all have one president. We all have one president. We see videos of local sheriffs talking to the crowds, bringing people together. Governors make speeches. Activists make speeches. Police officers make speeches. Police officers hug constituents, citizens. We have a lot of leaders, people stepping up, people trying to unite, people coming together, people being peaceful. There are little pressure valves sprinkled throughout society. But there's one big pressure valve or potential pressure valve in our system, the president of the United States. That's a role that only a president can play. Presidents have a unique role. They can crank up the pressure or they can alleviate it. No one else can do it with the same force, the same justification, the same authority that they can. No private citizen, no celebrity, no one but the president. It's their choice. A speech that makes sense to people can alleviate the pressure. A president who says rioting is not good, murder in the streets by the police is also not good. We understand the desire to protest, and peaceful protest is embedded in the fabric of our society. Here's what we're doing to stop rioting. Here's what we're doing to allow peaceful protest. And here's what we're doing to address the underlying reasons for those riots. I've watched the video. I'm as horrified as you. I've appointed a blue ribbon panel to investigate police brutality. I'm meeting with governors today to tell them they must increase the training of the police force. We'll provide federal support for this. They must root out the racists among themselves. We cannot live in a world where events like those captured on the George Floyd video are the norm. I'm not a policy expert, but I know policy when I hear it. I know when a politician, a Bill Clinton, a George W. Bush, a Barack Obama, is out there trying to reassure people that voices have been heard, that things will be addressed, that steps will be taken. Maybe people roll their eyes at those steps. Maybe the steps, in their view, are not enough. Maybe the adjustments to the pressure valve are insufficient. But they are adjustments to the pressure valve. That's what we're talking about. The valve. Addressing police brutality is sending the message, we understand that you have to live in the country with police and you want to feel like they protect and serve you, not that they are your enemy, not that you need to live in fear of them. We who wield that authority, who have been given that authority, understand that the power can be used for good or for ill, and that the power comes from your consent, and that if we abuse that power, we risk not having your consent. So here's what we're going to do to make sure that you agree that the system is fair, that the system works for you as it works for everyone. You might think it's not enough, but if you see that we're sincere, that we're hoping to take actions that you'll agree has made a difference, and at the very least, we hope you'll see that the people in power recognize that the power comes from you, and we're trying to make things better, and the effort is genuine. That would be a pressure valve. And that is not what we're getting. We're not getting that at all. We're getting increased pressure. We're in the old model of a pressure cooker on the stove where you don't release the valve, you tighten up the screws. You tighten the screws on the lid and you say, here's how we make sure this thing doesn't explode. Here's how we don't wind up with dinner on the ceiling and grandma being rushed to the ER. We'll just tighten the screws, make them stronger, make sure the lid is tight fitting, add a few more screws. It's the logic of lynching. It's the logic of strongmen and dictators. It's the logic of keeping people down, of having them know their place, quote unquote, of having them live in fear. It's the belief that the problem will go away if people are too scared to protest. I don't know that you need evidence. I'm sure you've heard the statements. The president, our president, has called protesters animals and thugs and told the police not to be too nice to them. If you don't dominate, he has said, you're wasting your time. That's what he told the governors yesterday. When the looting starts, the shooting starts, he said. And we are going to unleash the most vicious dogs on the protesters, he said those in tweets. Is that a pressure valve? Or is that creating more pressure? Is it governing through fear and power? I don't know why I'm even asking that as a question at this point. We have enough evidence to know how he sees the world. Well, you might want to live in an authoritarian government. You might love him and be angry that others don't. I remember reading the words of Mussolini, who said that people were tired of making decisions. They wanted to be told what to do. Maybe that's how you feel. Maybe that's how you want others to feel. Maybe you've convinced yourself that he's speaking for you, that you will do just fine. All that tear gas is for others. The bullets will be aimed at others. The dogs will not be coming for you. And maybe you are just fine with that. Maybe you think the problem is other people are complaining. And they're going to get what they deserve. Complaints means they deserve the dogs and the bullets and the tear gas. And maybe you're fine with that. So we are going to run an interview next week that I did with a writer named Amanda Stern. We're going to talk about a book called Letters to a Young Poet by Rainer Maria Rilke, the German poet. It's a beautiful book. And the interview, you are going to have to hear it for yourself. It's a must listen, I have to say. I don't think I've ever said that before. I've never done an interview like this one before. At one point, your humble host, Jack Wilson, starts to cry. It was kind of a moving experience. That book was important to me, very important to me and to her. And somehow, well, I won't spoil it. You'll hear it next week. And then we'll have Mike Palindrome on, and he and I will do our usual little soft shoe patter. We'll have some fun again. The interview with Amanda is fun too. She's an amazing person. I think you're really going to like this interview, but you know what I mean. Not everything is going to be dramatic. Even if the world is dramatic, even when the world is burning, that's what the history of literature is. We rise above, we take a broader view, a longer view, we dig into the past. That's what I want to do. I think it's valuable. I'm going to continue doing it. I'm not going to preface things with special episodes about the state of the world, special segments on the state of the world. The reason I mention this interview with Amanda is that the Rilke book is about how we want to live a life, and that's what she and I talk about. And this book helped me figure that out when I was in my early 20s. And another book I read around the same time did the same thing, The Second Sex by Simone de Beauvoir. And books like these made me look into myself and say, what do I want to be? How do I want to live? Do I want to live in a world of insecurity where I'm resentful of others, where I blame everyone around me, where I want to see them held down? Or do I want to look at the world in a spirit of love and generosity where I want others to do well, where I don't define myself by being superior to anyone, where I don't say that cracking down on this group or that group is good for me? Because I'm not in the group that's going to receive the blow. I don't want to live among people who are living in fear. Do you? Do you really? Is that the goal of your life? Do you think that's the best thing for your spirit, for your soul? Do you want to see hate towards women, hate towards children, hate towards innocent people? Do you? Do you really? Do you want to accept that as normal or inevitable? Do you want to justify that to yourself, to take every effort to make things equal as a personal affront to you and your people? Do you want to be that defensive? It's not something I understand. If a woman says, I want to be paid equally to a man when I do an equal job, when I do an equivalent job, I want to have an equivalent salary. Do you say, yes, absolutely. That makes sense. That's reasonable. That's a fair goal. I want you to feel like you're being valued. I share your goal. Or do you say, well, maybe men work harder, or maybe men are better. Maybe the statistics are wrong, and maybe women are getting married and having children, and on and on and on. Whatever excuses you find, just so you don't have to say the very simple thing of, yes, of course, that's a perfectly fine statement. I agree that that's a good goal. I understand why you want that. Equal job, equal pay, it's only fair. You will feel better about yourself, about your job, and I will be glad to have you as a spouse or a colleague or a neighbor or a friend, because I want to live among people who are happy and fulfilled and optimistic, not people who are harboring a grievance or resentment. When you say, the problem with you is that you're complaining too much, that's what you're saying. You're saying, if I put my fingers in my ears and can't hear you, I can pretend that you're happy because actually, I don't really care. I can pretend. I can block your unhappiness out. Isn't it better to live in a world where you just give a little, where you're saying, as a general rule, yes, I would rather live in a world with genuine equality, genuine opportunity. That world will be better for me. Even if I have to give up living in a world that's tilted in my favor, because we are all going to do better together if we have a sense that this society is working for all of us, that it's fair for all of us, that there isn't an us and a them, there is just an us. Isn't that how you want to live? Now I can hear the objection. Oh, kumbaya. Oh, that's kumbaya. This isn't kumbaya. I'm not saying let's pretend we can solve all our problems or snap our fingers and racism will end, or that we can pretend that racism and sexism and all the other isms are over. I'm asking you, you white person, you straight person, you male person, able-bodied person, legal citizen, whatever category you are, whatever gives you an advantage over someone else, you. I'm asking you that question. Do you want to press that advantage and hoard it and protect it and snarl at anyone who comes close to it? Or do you want to see those advantages extended to everyone? What kind of world would you rather live in? What kind of person would you rather be? So, we're a long way from literature today, or maybe we're not. Maybe this is a view I've developed from reading literature, or maybe it's setting out an approach I take to the world, which includes my approach to literature. Maybe that's my view. Pressure leads to conflict. Pressure leads to action. Action leads to plot. Plot reveals character. When we talk about writers, we're looking at pressure. We're looking at their motivations. We're looking at how that pressure was released. And when we're looking at characters, we're looking at the same thing. The pressures they're under, how that was generated, what contributed to it, how it escapes. Does it escape? Does it escape quietly? Is it released in some sense, or does it explode? I don't know if this episode, whatever it is, special episode, we're going to have 4 episodes this week. That is definitely a record. We've had months where we don't have 4 episodes. We will have 4 this week, 4 in 5 days. I don't know if this episode has a place here in our journey through the history of literature. I just know that I had to talk it through so that I could talk about literature again. Alice Munro Week continues tomorrow. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time.